This is Red Ice Radio, a beacon of sanity from Northern Europe. RedIceCreations.com.
Welcome, ladies and gentlemen. I'm Henrik, and you are listening to Red Ice Radio. We cover all things between heaven and hell, all things that we find interesting and important. Check out our archives, and I'm sure you'll be able to find something you want to learn more about. And you can listen when you want. All our programs are available for streaming or downloading from RedIceCreations.com, and you'll find our full archives at RedIceMembers.com. And you can hear a new episode 3 times per week, and every other week, one of these is our latest edition, Radio 314. Today we have Mike Cross back with us on the program to discuss psychopathy in politics. He is the author of Freedom from Conscience, Melanie's Journey, and Melanie's Awakening, the second book in the series. Mike, a former Oregonian, now a resident of Stockholm in Sweden, teaches psychology and international finance in a college preparation school in Stockholm. In the first hour, Mike talks about politicians, political campaigns, and the state. He presents theories on why society loves a psychopath. He also discusses how the masses are being transformed, turning society into a more warlike society. Welcome back, Mike. Good to have you with us again. I hope you had a good, I wouldn't call it summer that we experienced this year here up in Sweden, but you know, I hope you had a good pause between winters in any regard. It's good to have you back again.
Oh, thanks for having me on again.
Excellent. Now, by the way, I wanted to begin this discussion to tie back to last time we had you with us, and I wanted to ask if you caught the story coming out from Falun here in Sweden about the lunch lady, Annika Eriksson, who was instructed by the municipality to actually stop cooking good food for the kids at school because it wasn't fair or equal in order what the other kids were getting. Did you catch that story, Mike?
Yeah, I sure did. I thought that was really interesting how that if someone gets something special, that the government, even at the local level, can then come in and say that that's not fair to others, so it all has to be equalized. I would hope that maybe Americans that are listening to this take note of this very carefully.
Yep. It's an incredible important point, and there's of course many, many, many of these examples throughout the years that have been highlighting. I call it crab mentality, where one crab is trying to get out of the bucket, all the other ones are doing their best to drag the ones down. They're climbing on top of each other to drag the final one down. You know, so no one escapes, no one gets out of the bucket. It's amazing what they do in the name of egalitarianism. So what is happening to individuality, Mike?
Well, I think, and we've had. If you go back to writers, whether they be or philosophers, whether they be people like Nietzsche or Freud or whatever, throughout history, they do recognize that there's a problem with the state in regards to, well, the whole premise of the state is to form a unified block of people. I mean, that's what statism is all about. You make people feel like they're part of an organism instead of just individuals. Now, Nietzsche, of course, was probably the most inspirational when it comes to anarchy in that respect, saying that the state crushes the individual.
Yeah.
And that if you want, he has a quote, I'll just paraphrase it, that if you want to truly be an individual and be true to yourself, the tribe will make sure that they will punish you for that. And he also goes on to say that it's worth it to try to be the individual. Now, Freud talked about civilization in the same way. He recognized that you needed to have civilization, but he also saw that it, if you read his book, Civilization and Its Discontents, he saw that it also hurt and cause depression in the individual, because all of a sudden you have artificial rules. And whenever government officials get together, well, their purpose is to create new rules. And so the more rules you create, the more regulations you have, the less important the individual is. In fact, at some point, the individual becomes a threat to the collective mentality.
Yeah. It's well, it's very frightening to me when these kinds of examples come out, and how I mean, there was a little bit of a media coverage on this around the world, but I also found it interesting again, because that also shows another collective reflection, if you will, here, when there was some pressure being put on the city Falun or the municipality. They decided to revert back again and say, "Oh, it was all a misunderstanding. So it's okay. You can go ahead now and do it." But it also shows that whatever the collective then would put pressure on, maybe they would fall for that. Maybe they would give way for that. Which is kind of we get into this area of how our so-called morality and laws and rules, how that's being defined and by who, you know.
Well, I think if you go back. Again, I'm making reference to people. The people I make references to, I really hope people will investigate them. But if you go back to Bernays and his book Propaganda, which essentially our entire commercial industry, our spin doctors in government, everything's based on that book, ultimately. And he states that most people do not recognize where their individuality ends and someone else with their set ideas and agendas and beliefs, where they begin. And, you know, most people just accept it and just go on with life without thinking too much about is this the right way or is this the wrong way, which is very dangerous if you wind up in a situation in which, for instance, people that are psychopathic rise to the top. Because then they are the ones that are going to be setting the agenda. And if people just kind of go along with it, well, hang on for the ride, because you're not going to enjoy the destination.
Well, that's a good point. Again, when most people define their own moral compass according to what, you know, society deems to be moral, or what some of these people at top decides through the laws and everything what is moral, then we're in a pretty bad situation, aren't we? Can go quickly pretty bad from that point.
Well, the danger you have is that once people start believing that the collective is in some way smarter than they are, then they're going to leave themselves open. How many people would turn their computer on and start surfing the internet without any kind of firewall or virus protection whatsoever? I mean, most people realize that if you do that, you're opening yourself up to ruining your computer, especially if you're using a work computer or one in which you've got a lot of valuable data on. But yet they sit in front of a TV and take stuff in and don't question it, and it assimilates in your mind just like a computer. And so those, what you could call virus, the ideas that are coming across that go against the individual, against freedom, against questioning, become incorporated into the person.
Well, I wanted to comment on one thing here you said before, and that's about some of Bernays' things, and I think you have a different take on this, because mostly what I've heard is that what he advocated and everything else, although he was manipulating the collective, if you will, what I've heard from people like Adam Curtis, if you're familiar with him, filmmaker from, you know, the BBC, he tried to connect some of the psychology on that it was mass psychology, but it's ultimately, well, with his The Center of the Self documentary, which is excellent, by the way, but it's kind of saying that this is, you know, the commerce and the ego kind of goes hand in hand, and this is like a selfish society that these people have created. But I would tend not to agree with that. I think that this is very much targeted towards the collective of creating a very selfless human being. Sure, they might be focused upon themselves ultimately of how they would get ahead or whatever, but ultimately they're driven by what everyone else thinks about them and what everyone else is doing, and they're trying their best to kind of fit into that collective. What would you say about that, Mike?
Well, you're saying that you feel that, well, I mean, I've seen the Adam Curtis documentary, including also, he has another excellent documentary I'd encourage people to look at, and that is dealing with the power of nightmares, dealing with the whole Middle East and terrorism and stuff like that, and how politicians have used this to their advantage. But my take on Bernays is essentially this. He was the cousin. Well, he's actually, according to marriage, I think he's like both cousin and nephew of Sigmund Freud. But at least we know he's a nephew. I know that for certain. Freud wrote his stuff so that he could use it in psychotherapy, and he was very academic. So psychologists, psychiatrists, professors would be able to use this insight into what motivates people, why people behave the way they do, what they really want, and so forth, so he could help them in the long run. Bernays took his book and then applied it to advertising and essentially found that the human being is not really motivated. Not most. I mean, maybe some. I mean, George Bernard Shaw said that only 3% of people think, 3% of people think they think, and 97% just don't have any original thoughts whatsoever. I don't know if it's that bad, but...
Probably. But, yeah.
Sometimes it feels this way.
I mean, it sure does, when you
go on the internet and there's something exposing, like, corruption or really nasty things that maybe NATO does in the Middle East or something like that, you see they have, you know, maybe a 500 or 1,000 views. Then you type in something about, you know, kitty cats, and there's 25 million views, or, you know, something about, you know, my friend got diarrhea and 17 million views, you know, that sort of thing. So sometimes I think maybe Shaw's right. But the thing is that advertising in that sense became geared towards people's insecurities. You try to sell them stuff based on sexuality, on power, these kinds of things. And I mean, everyone now knows. I mean, Bernays came up with the idea. You know, you see a guy driving a big Hummer and you're like, oh, I guess he's compensating for something he doesn't have.
Right.
You know, this is, we all speak Freud. We can't help it. And then most of that's based on Bernays, who mainstreamed all of this stuff. And then the politicians started getting involved with it. I mean, as the documentary points out, the people, especially when Anna Freud took over Freud and so forth, the psychological movement, the commercial industry, the politicians were all wanting this kind of way to deal with people. To the point now that when we hear that the politicians are preparing for the debate, they're preparing to be able to say things to where the population will like it and vote for them.
Yeah.
Why don't they just say it the way it is? I mean, they're not preparing so they'll have their facts on hand. They're not preparing so they'll be able to present their ideology to the people. They're preparing so that they'll get that coveted zinger, they call it now. I mean, media just says it. That coveted zinger, or soundbite, as it used to be called, that will sink the other politician. You know, that it's like watching a gladiator game. You know, you got two bloody gladiators, and one of them gets that knife in. And the crowd roars, you know, and that's what they're looking for the next debate with Romney and Obama. Yeah. If Obama can get his knife in, then he wins the election. If Romney gets his into Obama, all of a sudden we know that Romney's going to win. But they're not doing these debates anymore to inform people, like maybe the Lincoln-Douglas debates of the late 1850s were. They're doing this so that they can, you know, get that manipulation in there and get the majority of people feeling something. Even though if you ask the average person, well, what did he just say? Well, I don't know, but it sounded good.
Yeah, it's true. And it's very superficial these days, as we know. It's about having the right, you know, kind of polish on the shoe to the degree where it's not too shiny, so you only identify, you know, with the, well, more elite than I can guess we can call it, or high finance people. But you don't want to have it, you know, you want to have it a certain degree of shininess as well, but not too much. It's become a different kind of game these days. I mean, Mitt Romney now in the latest here was accused of actually dyeing his face brown. Did you hear about that? To appeal to the Latino voting audience?
Well, I should just point out that under law in America, he could technically claim to be Mexican because, you know, his family came from there, you know. So, but the thing is, I wouldn't be surprised. I mean, these campaigns are micromanaged. I don't think that Ann Romney shows up to any event where they have not decided what color her dress should be, what length it should be, what it looks like. I mean, you don't pay people millions and millions and millions of dollars to run a campaign and then let them dress themselves.
Right, yeah.
I mean, this is all micromanaged. I mean, when Ann Romney was on Leno, I don't know, maybe they were trying to appeal to the young men that have kind of a thing for older women that are in great shape and dress nice. And you know what I mean? I mean, that must have been brought up when they were thinking, okay, well, how should she appear for this show?
Right.
And the same goes true for Obama. I mean, these guys are as much merchandised as a car would be, or a logo on a famous athlete. You want them to be associated with a certain thing. Now, does the public get anything out of that? No. They get nothing really of substance. But does the public want substance? That's the question. That's what's kind of scary. And then you have to ask yourself, when we're dealing with like people that are psychopathic, why does the public seem to fall in love with the archetypical psychopath?
And they wouldn't do it openly, but on a subconscious level, they probably identify with them, right?
Well, yeah, I've got some theories on that I could go into as to why people seem to connect to these people. I mean, when you're reading a book, I mean, the way I wrote my book, I mean, the main character does really nasty things. In a second book, there's all kinds of relationship deceit and so forth. But the reader still finds themselves, oh, I feel really sorry for her in this situation. Someone told me recently, they sent me an email saying, I'm reading your book. I really identify with this girl. You're going, oh, great, you know. But hey, we live in a culture where vampires are now our superheroes. You couldn't have Superman and these people from the 50s anymore, you know. These are not superheroes for the population. Our superheroes drink blood and are self-obsessed and do all these other weird things. But they are our superheroes. And I'm wondering, I mean, if we're going to go back to psychology, could it be? I mean, I'd like audience members to ask themselves if this could be the explanation. The psychopath has no, what Freud called, I'm just using Freudian language here to make it understandable, they have no what's called the superego. And that's the part that basically, if you think about the old Donald Duck cartoons where you got the angel on one shoulder and the devil on the other, telling, you know, one saying, you know, Donald, you're a good person, don't kill the chipmunk or whatever, right. And the other one saying, do it, you know you want to do it. The psychopath doesn't have that angel on there.
No internal dialogue like this.
They don't have that internal dialogue. That could get them in trouble. I've heard that psychopaths, after they may say things and do things, they actually go, oh, why did I say that for? They don't think the way we might go, oh, ooh, I better not say that. You know, if it's for a good laugh or popularity, they'll say it. And then afterwards they might go, maybe I'll get in trouble for that. They won't feel bad about it. They'll just, you know, if they're telling jokes about their boss, maybe they'll, and then the boss walks in, then they feel like, oh, that was not good. But they won't feel bad that they were insulting their boss or their wife or their husband or whatever. But the average person develops a superego at a very young age. And what that really entails is what your parents, your church, synagogue, mosque, whatever, and society in general has said this is right and this is wrong. So we write these rules in our heart. And when no one's looking, and I think all Swedes understand this because it's been, you know, described with the Swedish society a lot, that you don't need a policeman. You've got a policeman already in your head or your heart.
Yeah, that's right.
So if you do something wrong, if you do something wrong, you have that angel on the right shoulder lecturing you about it. Oh, that was bad. You should not have done this. You're an awful person. Your mom would be ashamed of you. That sort of thing. Mm-hmm. The psychopath doesn't have that. Everything's cost and effect to them. If they're smart, if they have a certain amount of discipline, they're not going to do things to ruin themselves. They're not the ones at a bar that they get mad and break a bottle over someone's head and kill them. They're going to be more calculating. They might put poison in someone's drink, but they're not going to do something so dramatic. Not the smart ones. And I think what happens, though, is people repress a lot of their a lot of the things that they might normally want to do. I mean, everyone still has instincts and drives and so forth. They still might get mad at the person that bumps into them on the subway or cuts them off on the street and whatever. They are going to quickly, though, get that out of their mind. They're not going to act on it. They're going to find some way to forget it or rationalize or whatever. Now, the psychopath, on the other hand, will react to those things, and they will try to find revenge or whatever, but they might try to do it long term. Now, back to the, you know, kind of the original point, the average person, though, will repress these things. They repress all these guilty feelings, all of these urges and instincts, and they're wanting to get revenge on people. Then a psychopath comes along that starts to enact laws and kind of gives them permission to act on those particular repressed ideas. Now, here's the danger, and this is kind of controversial, but I'm going to say this. The danger is that if parents have raised their children in which they say, oh, obey, the government makes rules because that's the right thing. They wouldn't do it otherwise. You listen to a police officer. You do what he says. That gets incorporated as part of the control mechanism of the superego. Mm-hmm. Then if you have a situation where the government or the police tell you to do something wrong, this creates a psychological condition known as cognitive dissonance. And here's the ultimate irony. When you do something that you know is wrong, but someone's given you permission that you won't get in trouble for doing it, your brain actually rewards you with serotonin. You know, when you do something bad, I mean, when someone lies, you know, and they're scared, the irony is the brain's rewarding them. But, you know, of course, in 97% of the population, afterwards, they're like, oh, I shouldn't have done that. That's just like a woman might commit adultery on her husband. She may love her husband very much, but all of a sudden, she's got this huge rush of these endorphins hitting her brain. And she feels real great when she's sneaking around. Later, she feels guilty. Oh, I should not have done that. That's wrong. And so forth. That small percentage of people that are psychopaths don't feel that. They don't feel it, but they can use that particular strength, I'll call it a strength, mm-hmm. to manipulate the people around them. So the psychopath might be having the affair with the woman on an interpersonal situation. He's not going to feel any guilt whatsoever. And he's just going to do it because that's what he does. The woman feels the guilt. She feels bad. Well, the more guilt she feels, ultimately, the more power the psychopath may have over her, because now she feels alienated. So the psychopath comes along next time and says, oh, come on, you know, I know you're feeling bad, but, and by the time he's done, she's doing it again. Now, put that on a societal basis in which the government is going against what maybe is a cherished ideal. Well, we can see that in the United States. A lot, you know, the Fourth Amendment doesn't even seem to exist anymore in the United States. Not when you have sensors that can basically tell, they're installing sensors that can tell what kind of molecules are emanating from your body. I mean, they can analyze everything. Everything you've done, they know maybe what you've been drinking, what you've been eating, even if you've been with another person, you know, because they might, oh, well, this person's emitting chemical substances that, you know, that's a man, but there's female, you know, scent coming off of him. Yeah, this is crazy. I mean, this is science fiction, and it's, and the idea now, everyone accepts it. You tell a group of people, you know, everything you say on a cell phone is recorded somewhere. Everything you send on an email is recorded somewhere. And they just kind of look at it like, yeah, but it's the government doing it. They must know what's right.
Doing it to protect us, right?
Yeah. So you know, if they sneak, if someone's looking in your bedroom window in the middle of the night, you know, that's illegal. And you're going to feel very violated by that. And that's just going to tick you off because you've been told that's wrong. Normal people don't do that. But if you find out the government's watching what you're looking at on the internet and they have a list of all the websites you go to, they know what picture you just sent to your wife or your husband or whatever just for fun, and they have it stored, and it's like, oh, but that's okay. The government's doing it. So we have this trust in this big entity, this big government, because we've been trained to believe. Well, they must know what's right. And then you have these images that come in your mind, like the nice policeman smiling and coming to your school in grade school and telling you about how we have to follow the law and all those kinds of things. Or, you know, something you read, in sixth grade, when you were 6 years old, about public servants helping the people and so forth. So we freak out if someone's staring through our window. Some women freak out if a guy looks at her blouse because she has a low-cut blouse, you know, and she's like, oh, what a pervert. But yet the government's watching you every moment.
Yeah. What would you say, what kind of entity has government become and who's running it? If you could paint a picture for, let's say, those who actually are in a position of trusting government and thinking, you know, whatever they decide, that's the right thing to do, that's the moral thing. Just as long as you go along with them, you can't do anything wrong.
Well, the sky's the limit, ultimately, isn't it? I mean, if people have this idea that the government is right, then they won't go at it immediately. You don't want to cause people to panic. You know, if you're a wolf, you don't charge right into the sheep immediately. You kind of herd them around a little bit. You know, the pack gets them in the corner. Then, you know, you can do whatever you want with them. The thing is, we've always had, I'm not calling for anarchy. I'm not saying that we should just all go do whatever, because I think Freud's probably right. A lot of people would do very nasty things to each other if we did. But at the same time, we've always had somewhat of a checks and balances in our democratic societies. And government has usually, and I'm going to, you know, deal a lot with America here, the American people, there's always been this kind of sense that government officials have had, like, well, we can't go too far here. People are not going to like it. But now, as we see a more militaristic society, a more conformist society, a more trust-what-you-hear society, that seems to be not amongst everyone, but amongst a very large percentage of the population, the more you see you can get away with, the more you'll do. Take it back to what I said about adultery. If the husband comes home and she tells him, well, sorry, honey, I was sleeping with your best friend. And he goes, oh, well, that's okay. You know, I haven't been helping you around the house. And so, well, he's just given her permission now to go out and do it again. And maybe expand her search this time. Well, the thing is, if the people basically look at things like, you know, shipping guns to Mexican drug lords or bombing people without any, you know, when they haven't done anything to us, or and so forth, And they accept that. They're too busy looking at Justin Bieber and dancing kitty cats and, you know, whatever. You know, and they're not really, really making a big effort to find out what's going on. That just means the government will go a little further next time. And a little further until finally, like you said with the crabs are in a pot and the water's on a stove. And it's heating up. You know, there'll be a point of no return where basically no one's going to be crawling out because they're all going to be cooking.
Yep.
Yep.
So this is tippy-toe tactics as well, which means that they know that they have something to hide. Otherwise, they would, as you say, just kind of charge straight into it because it would be the right thing to do, right?
Yeah, there's enough people that still have this mentality that it is that it's still wrong. I mean, you still create sound bites and kind of veer people away from the truth. And that's exactly what a psychopath does. You know, most of your really good psychopaths, they don't come right out and give you a flat out lie. They're not going to tell you the car they're trying to sell you runs like it's brand new when it's 15 years old. But they will say, oh yeah, we've had no troubles with this car. It's really nice, you know, and for its age. And they know that maybe they know the engine only has a few thousand kilometers left on it. You know, but they, and that's the same way when you sell something to someone and you know it's wrong that what you're selling, you find a way to word it to where they'll accept it. And that's where I think the government has learned a lot from Bernays. I mean, they're not selling, the government's selling wars. They're not selling soap, but they're selling wars. And if you ask a lot of people in America, I saw one of those man on the street things from some independent news show on the internet.
Mm-hmm.
And they were just asking people at these were people like going to some Democratic function, Democrat Party, you know, Obama function. And they were just asking them on the street, well, what do you think of the war in Libya? And they're like, well, that wasn't really a war. But you're saying Obama supports peace. And they're going, yeah, he does. And then they say, but what about Libya? That wasn't a war. Or they'll say, oh, yeah, NATO forced him to do it. Or you're going, what? I mean, that's like saying Finland forced Germany to invade Russia. Yeah, they went along for the ride. I mean, they contributed troops to invade Russia. I mean, because they'd been attacked by the Russians earlier. But to say that Obama was forced to go into Libya because Europe made him do it is, again, like saying, well, Germany wasn't the one that wanted to go into Russia. It was the Finns that wanted to go into Russia. I mean, it would be as atrocious.
So the masses are being changed, molded, and some have said that it's to make us or the majority more like them, and that society as a whole then is being transformed and changed into something new with this kind of sliding morality, and slowly we're getting accustomed to what we, you know, maybe only 20, 30, or I mean definitely 40, 50 years ago would have seen as being atrocious. So what's happening? What's going on here?
Well, there's a couple things. And again, I'm going to pick on the United States, but I see the same thing happening in Europe. One is that the psychopath, one of the traits they have is thrill. They're thrill seekers. They're actually low. Everywhere I read that the psychopath tends to have a low level of serotonin in their brain, which means they need to feel alive. They need to take risk. They need to do things that put them out there. Maybe in the old days, that was a good trait. You know, if there's a lion that keeps coming into your village and snatching kids or something, it may have been somewhat of a psychopath who's like, whoa, I know how to get popular. And he goes out and kills the lion and comes back carrying the lion. Well, the women are all like, yeah, we want your baby and this sort of thing.
wait a minute. That's a good point to them, because I wanted to ask as well how it could be that some of these people manage to rise to positions of power. And that, again, my point there was that it has to be because other people surrounding them have a kind of an admiration for what they do, or something that they must look like some kind of, they have some kind of superhuman capability. So this would explain that with what you just said, then, in a way.
Well, yeah, and they also are fulfilling a need. Remember what I said about the repression? You know, that people repress things, and that's not, that, again, that's very Freudian. I would encourage people to really read Freud. I mean, it's... some of his stuff, if you don't take it metaphorically, sounds pretty atrocious. But if you actually look at what it is that he talks about, it makes a lot of sense. And it's, of course, it's been used in a lot of your psychological experiments over the years. It's been, I mean, the elite seem to have a thing for Freud, but yet they kind of diminish it for the rest of the people. It's kind of like that theory that our elitists tend to be very anti-religious, but at the same time, they are incredibly spiritualist. I mean, I really don't think we have very many of our elite if we go by the fact of some of the groups they belong to and some of the, you know, weird things that you might see that they take part in, whether it's, you know, some shrine in Northern California, you know, in the Redwoods or or whatever. They're obviously somewhat spiritualistic. Maybe they want the rest of the population to be kind of blank, and because that makes it easier to exploit them. But the psychopath actually, the psychopath wants to be the ones that keep things going. So part of their nature is to kind of say, well, how far can I push this? Like, again, go back to the woman having the affair with the psychopath. He's going to push it as far as he can do it. Maybe in a, you know, a couple times with her, he's going, oh, do you have a friend that can join us? You know, he's going to just keep pushing it to see if he can just, you know, because he has no qualms about it. It's not hurting him. He's just going to keep on with her until she finally just leaves or he's done with her. And that's, but the thing is, we're attracted to these people because, again, they give us a serotonin rush because we've repressed all these desires. They're giving us permission to use them. Look at, I hate to use Nazi Germany. Everyone talks about Nazi Germany and, you know, History Channel type thing, you know, Hitler's Christmas or those kinds of weird things.
Right.
But the thing is, when he gave speeches, he would actually start out by just criticizing the German people. He'd get up and give a speech like, well, you guys haven't been working hard enough. And then he starts saying, but I know you can do better. I know you can do this. I have faith in you. And they're all like cheering and almost to a point of ecstasy. You know, a very good rhetorical style.
Being a kind of a disciplinarian, a tough father that shows some, you know, shows them bounds basically and tell them that they can achieve better. So people like this, they're drawn to that. They want to hear it as it is, right, on one level. And some of these people are not, they're not afraid to tell it how it is at the same time, right? This is a social thing that most people then would kind of veer away from. They try to avoid that, walk around the elephant in the room, right? While these people go, they kind of strike the jugular right away.
Yeah. Yeah, and again, they have no social conscience, whereas most people feel kind of a, oh no, I can't say this, I can't do that. It's kind of like these people that train men to be pickup artists. And, you know, they'll give them these psychological clues to look for and all this stuff. And it's all designed to manipulate women. Most of the time, it's not to get a relationship going. It's just basically, you know, to be able to pick women up for one-night stands.
Yeah.
And part of it is give a little compliment, then say something to diminish their self-esteem, and then give them something to make them feel good. And then give them permission to act out on their instincts. And all of a sudden, you know, you've got them. And that's what politicians do, whether consciously or unconsciously, who knows. But something I was going to point out very interesting, and there's a psychologist. He's written some books on the anthropology of sexuality. His name's Christopher Ryan. And he was pointing out in a speech that I watched that he seems to feel that we are developing more and more into kind of a culture of violence, at least in the United States. And he pointed out, and this is kind of ironic, he was pointing out that that they've done studies. I mean, he was citing someone else's study, but cultures where there is a lot of physical touching and closeness usually have the lowest level of war. But countries that repress that you know, I'm getting into the Freud stuff, you know, repress, you know, those kind of times when you feel like, oh, I'd like to hug this person. They seem to be sad, but you're like, no, that wouldn't be appropriate. What would they think of me? These kind of societies actually go to war more. And, you know, if we, it seems that we do create warriors. He pointed that out. And, take a look at what, you know, in America, you have this thing where a lot of schools now, you know, it's kind of funny. My daughter, who goes to a school in Sweden, one day they were doing a thing where it was how to have relaxation. And so they gave each other a back massage in class when she's like in fifth or sixth grade. In America, on the other hand, you have schools where if, you know, a girl comes to school and she's like, my grandma died, and she starts crying and her best friend puts her arm around her, they kick the kids out for sexual harassment. You know, they're not supposed to touch one another. No holding hands. Even kids playing football. No, you're getting too close to each other. So we're actually creating, I think we're actually setting up a warlike society. You know, and it's at every level. I mean,
Do you think that's the purpose?
Oh, I definitely know there's a purpose behind it. I mean, take a look. I mean, if I don't think, I mean, what was it? Franklin Roosevelt said nothing happens by accident. If Christopher Ryan's ideas are correct, it seems like we should be encouraging people to be more like open and give each other hugs and all this kind of stuff. But instead, we see laws that are being enacted where, you know, there's been kids at 6 years old have, you know, a little girl will give a boy a kiss and they're both expelled from school. Hmm. 6 years old. We're training them that, no, you don't get close to people. And so this is going to build this, if these studies are right, it's just going to feed into it. And at the same time, look at the Olympic team. I mean, the American team was the only team that was dressed up like they were going to a military academy. Hmm. You know, I mean, did you see that? I mean, the blue outfits and sure. The berets.
The berets, yeah. I remember that.
Yeah. I mean, what? I mean, other countries either dress traditional clothes or they, you know, the Chinese wore normal clothes. The Russians, normal clothes. Brazilians, Indians, Iranians, whoever. They wore regular type clothes. The Americans come in dressed like they're going to West Point. And then there was people that were winning sports events, and instead of waving to the audience, they were saluting the audience. I mean, this is where did this come from? I mean, did they just do this because they were dressed that way? I mean, someone had to be kind of encouraging it. I mean, I've never seen a person salute in a sports event until then, salute an audience.
Mm-hmm.
You know, I mean, I don't even think they would do that in an Army-Navy game or something like that, at least in the old days. I mean, it's like we're blending in, we're creating a society that is very psychological. I don't think it's necessarily something that's just happening. I think it's something that is being cultivated.
Yeah, being planned this way for obvious reasons, and they want to have the population being a certain something. I've said in many shows before that it's almost like they are grooming America to be the military force of the New World Order. And I mean, there's many people who've said that before me as well. And when we look at these kinds of finer details on this kind of psychological level, then it shows that there is an awareness there about how to do these things. So again, the question is how well planned and thought out is this? And that would mean that someone has incredible control in terms of what to do and how to do it, from sport events, as you say, to how kids in school are being treated. Okay, certainly some of it might be an unconscious process, but most of it seems to be kind of regulated and controlled this way then. Who's pulling the strings here, do you think, Mike? Who's doing this? Who's telling them to act like this?
Well, there you don't have a complete answer. I mean, you can see that there Well, first of all, when it comes to government stuff, when it comes to this whole idea of accepting government, if I would have told someone 10 years ago or 15 years ago that you'd walk into a Walmart and you would have a telescreen, I wonder what movie does that sound like it's from? Telescreen, in which a leader is on there telling you to report anything you see suspicious about your neighbor.
Was that Napolitani? I always mess up her name.
Napolitano.
Thank you. There you go.
I always wonder if she's related to Judge Napolitano.
Yeah, exactly.
I don't think he'd brag about it if he was. But you know, you have a situation in which people are used to that now. She's on there, you know, see something, say something, and suddenly people start getting this, oh, that's right. I better, you know, those people down the street, they do act kind of funny, and I wonder how many guns they have, and they seem to store a lot of food, and, you know, those kinds of things. I think through the government, and of course they train police. I mean, look at, again, I mean, think of the psychology involved here. If you watch anything dealing with police training before 2001, I mean, a cop would graduate an academy, and they kind of came in just like any other high school or college group would, and sit down in their chairs and hear a speech, and then they'd get their diploma, and yay, now they can go out and apply to be cops. Now, oh my gosh, you know, the other day my wife had turned on one of those documentaries about Vegas and cops and stuff. It looked like they were in boot camp. I mean, it looked like they were in a military unit. You know, you did the about faces, you did the salutes, and all this other stuff. What? I think it was Vegas, but it was – everything seems to be that way. And then there was a TV show. I'm not going to name names because, you know, everything, but there was a TV program that's supposed to be about cops. And they had a graduating class in this program. And this class walks in, they're marching in and taking their seats when they, you know, get their order, and they all sit down. You know, Hollywood does not do a lot of – I mean, Hollywood, we know in the 1940s, did propaganda films. I don't think that connection ever died.
Yeah.
I mean, we know that the military is sold to kids. I mean – when they do a movie about someone on an aircraft carrier, think about how much money that costs the military to have to accommodate a film crew.
Sure.
I mean, and you're talking about on a multi-billion dollar vessel. And then you have people on that vessel playing. I mean, this is designed to make it look cool. So those young men that are taking their girlfriends to the movie are suddenly going, wow, that looks fun to work on an aircraft carrier. Then he says something to his girlfriend, you know, and she's like, yeah, that looks really cool. You know, so you get that whole tribal mentality of, oh, my woman says that would be cool too. And to a 17-year-old, you know, full of testosterone, he's down at the, you know, if he comes from this culture, of course, not rich kids. The rich kids don't join the military. It's the kids that don't have, you know, everything given to them. So I don't think there's any Romneys or Obamas in
Never
planning on going in the military anytime soon.
Yep.
They have this culture that almost sounds Platonic, you know, Plato's Republic. People that come from kind of this lower middle class type atmosphere where it's like, yeah, you know, I'm going to go join the military. My dad served, I'm going to go serve, my little brother's going to serve, and it's becoming a tradition now.
Yeah.
And it's reinforced through, you know, not just those recruitment ads you can see on YouTube. Type in stuff like Navy, Army, Air Force recruitment. You know, like a music video. You know, it looks real exciting to go drive big tanks and fly airplanes and stuff like that.
Well, and at the same time, then they have to appeal and draw to something because, again, many other countries in Europe, they have mandatory military training. And I mean, there hasn't been – it was a long time ago now since there was a draft in the U.S., so there is another – there's another type of marketing that obviously is there for that reason, I think, Mike. But on top of that, with the budget that the U.S. Army has, it's kind of understandable that they would do these kinds of targeting these kinds of groups to get people in there. In some cases, this is how people you know, when there's nowhere else to go job-wise or education-wise, or even if you want to pay off your student loan or whatever, military is now, you know, one of the best alternatives, if not the best.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, because right now it's really hard to get part-time jobs. Like, I mean, university costs have gone up. A job availability, those kind of jobs kids could work at during the summer, those are gone. In fact, with the economy being what it is, their dads or grandfathers might be trying to get those jobs.
That's right. Right. Yeah.
I mean, when I was in the United States, in Oregon, last summer, not this last summer, but the summer before, you know, I mean, you'd see guys that look like they were like 60 driving pizza cars, delivering pizza, or working at the local taco places and stuff like that, because they, you know, but now they're listed as employed for those Obama, you know, statistics. They're the, you know, job training, you know, right. Job statistics. If you lost your job as a manager of a hardware store or something, but now you're working at, you know, making hamburgers, you're gainfully employed.
Yep.
According to those statistics. So, yeah, and for politicians, I just want to give this example before I forget. Here's an example that at least shows that every politician in the Western world lies. Every one of them. And that's when they talk about full employment. There's not a politician in the Western world who does not promise that they're going to do everything they can to make sure everyone is fully employed. Romney does it. Obama does it. Leaders in Europe do it. And we know they're lying through their teeth. Or they at least have a different attitude of what full employment is. Because the agreed upon full employment in their minds is 4.5% unemployment. 4.5. And there's a reason for that. That 1 in 25. Now, 4.5 doesn't really give people a mental image. But if you're thinking about maybe a classroom in which you have 25 people sitting there, and one of them is out of work, that sounds like, oh my gosh, that's actually quite a bit. You know, that's 24 people are working, but one guy doesn't have any money. Well, the thing is, the Federal Reserve, European Central Bank, whatever, if the unemployment drops below that 4.5%, they're going to be scared of inflation, because now all of a sudden people are going to be demanding higher wages. Oh, that's terrible. I mean, huh, you know, you're going to actually want to be paid a family wage when you're doing work. So they're going to be demanding more money. Well, of course, excuse there. Well, that's going to increase inflation, because if an employer suddenly finds out they have to pay an extra dollar or extra 10 kroner or an extra, you know, whatever some of these other countries, you know, monetary systems are, that they're going to have to pay more to get good employees because someone else down the street may be at, you know, offering them a better job, then they're going to pass that on in their food cost or their car cost or sure. their whatever they're selling cost. And so our economic leaders, our elite, have decided that inflation is so dangerous because then, you know, it hurts the stock market and the bond market, which, of course, none of the poor people are part of. I mean, at least directly, they're not part of these big markets. They're not players. But these players don't want to wind up that their millions of dollars invested suddenly becomes less valuable to them. So that's when you raise the interest rates, so that you slow the economy down, so you don't have someone expanding and having to hire several more people at his local kebab store sure. or, you know, these kinds of things. And they all understand that. They know the public, when they hear full employment, thinks everyone in my neighborhood will be working. But what they really mean is, well, 24 of them will be working, but one of them has to always be unemployed. Yeah. And then, of course, the left comes along and says, well, yeah, that one person unemployed, we should give more welfare to. Well, then that means you have to still slow the economy down because he's not looking for work now. So yep. you get this spiral that takes place.
It's a game they play very well back and forth, and it serves them to have people in this position in different ways politically. We know that. I remember my grandfather, he always says, don't try to push for higher salaries. Try to instead just get, you know, lower prices. Otherwise, it will always go towards inflation. It will always be, okay, if you get a higher salary, they just will knock up the prices in, you know, the local food, you know, grocery store or whatever. It's like an endless game, and it also gives us an illusion that it's some kind of progress or that something actually is happening, and then we get runaway inflation. Look at, you know, Italy with their lira before the euro and everything else. You have to have millions to be able to, you know, buy cheap things. So it's kind of ridiculous in that way. It's like nothing is really happening, but it gives you the impression that things are going, you know, forward or in one direction anyway. So
yeah, but I'd like to at least, I mean, I think people would find it refreshing. This is the irony. It would be refreshing if Romney would get up and say, we need to bring unemployment down to 4.5%. Now, the others, we need to have them unemployed so that wages don't go up for people. People would look at him like, what? I'm not voting for this guy. Do you hear what crazy stuff he's talking about?
Sure.
Obama says he wants everyone working. I mean, they wouldn't, you know, they didn't buy Ron Paul. They're not going to buy Mitt Romney if he says that. So, of course, everyone has to play the game, you know, and play this, well, I guess you could say lie.
Oh, sure. Of course. Absolutely. And, it's no doubt about that.
And who better to tell lies than psychopaths?
Well, there you go.
Yeah, they're going to be the ones that will be golden tongued orators.
Yeah.
Because they can say these things to people. They can walk in, they can be like the person that walks into a plant in Wisconsin. And at the same time, they're working to make sure that plant's operation has a smooth transition to Beijing. They're going to tell the workers, I'm going to make sure that you guys have a place to come and work next year in this plant.
Yeah.
And everyone applauds, and then next year they're out of work.
Yeah. Yeah, it's really sad, isn't it?
No, it's like with our politicians. I mean, Nietzsche pointed out that often government winds up, you know, politicians go in that play to the lowest common denominator.
Yeah.
Do you really think that Obama and Romney like to go to baseball games? I mean, you know, they go on during the election year because they want to be seen as one of the people.
Yeah.
They dress down, you know, I'm sure they're still designer clothes, but they're still wearing stuff that looks like a jacket and, you know,
their baseball cap or whatever. Yeah.
And then they go on these daytime talk shows that, you know, I mean, they're not exactly I would never imagine Dwight Eisenhower or John F. Kennedy going on a daytime talk show and talking about what his wife's cooking for dinner.
Yeah.
Or something.
Mm. It's changed, and it's a different kind of media climate too, and they have to really target all the different brackets of groups, and everybody has to kind of identify with the incoming, you know, president or the one they're going to vote for. So they have to see them in all these different settings, you know, to be able to kind of appeal and talk to them. Mike, in a little bit, I want to take a break here between the segment, but there's one more point I want to squeeze in here before we take the break. And I'll get you. Want to give you a little opportunity to talk more about the second novel here as well in the series. But psychopath, you know, that word, it's to me anyway, from my perspective, has turned into a buzzword as well. And I want to kind of ask you a little bit how we avoid of falling into the trap of calling everybody that we don't agree with or that have a, you know, different opinion than us a psychopath, because I've seen that, you know, thrown around here and there, and it's an easy way to kind of disqualify someone. But I think it's kind of a mistake to do it, and it doesn't really apply in every scenario either. Have you experienced this as well?
Well, except for the fact that I've had a couple readers question my particular personality because they feel like, how did you get? I had someone who's has a relative that's trained for psychiatry, and she read my book, and she was convinced I have to be a psychopath because how could I have gotten their personality so right? I mean, that was so, yeah, I mean, it does get thrown around. I mean,
sure.
I was talking to a nurse and she said, yeah, but it's also about a woman too. And you don't look like a woman. So, yeah, took that as very nice. She'd read my book too. She liked it. But, But no, the thing is that I would really encourage people that when they hear that term, educate yourselves. And I always just say, you know, first of all, well, read my book. I mean, you could read either of the novels. They are designed to be able to show you how a psychopath thinks. So just look up Freedom from Conscience, and both of them, Freedom from Conscience, Melanie's Journey, and Freedom from Conscience, Melanie's Awakening. And you would see that. But for just a real quick look, go to any of Robert Hare's psychopathic checklist. There are people have stuff all over the internet, and they have the 20 characteristics. Now, not every psychopath fits all 20. It's very rare for someone to fit all 20. But if you fit some of the biggies, like the desire for never to be, you know, you're easily bored, you have no empathy, you're extremely good at being able to charm people, but in kind of a superficial way. And, you know, you can basically, essentially, you can say whatever and believe it. Almost like it's, you could just, you know, you could deal with stuff that make you look like some sort of, you're the savior, you're the whatever, you're the 12th mom, whatever, you are the thing. Watch your politicians afterwards. Do they sit around talking about how wonderful they are, what they've accomplished, and then making promises that you know cannot be fulfilled, and then trying to, you know, eat away at the other person in ways that maybe are unfair. And now, unfortunately, now you get games where politicians from both parties in America, and, you know, when they're running for parliament over in England and, you know, elsewhere, they'll twist things around and try to give people the impression that they're basically running against Satan themselves. If you get those kinds of politicians, especially in the countries like England or the United States, where they're very open, as opposed to, I mean, in many European countries, we have parliaments, and you don't really learn a lot about the individual because it's the party you vote for, and then they install the person. That's changing a little bit, but it's still the party. But if you watch these politicians, I don't care if they're in America, they're running for mayor, they're running for Senate, they're running for state legislature, president, whatever. Check and see if they're too good to be true and too calm to be true.
Yeah. Yeah, it's a good point. I found the O'Hare, or not O'Hare, that's the wrong, Robert Hare, his psychopathy checklist, basically. I'm going to link that up as well so people can find it that easy and do what Mike suggested here. Have a look at the politician in your area or whatever and run them through the checklist and have a look for yourselves. It's really interesting. Now, before we take a break here, Mike, where do people go to pick up copies of your books, Mike?
Well, if you just type in, I mean, if you're in Sweden, you'd go to Libris or Bookus, but in America or anywhere else, actually, it's offered on Amazon. So you just go to Amazon.com, type in Freedom from Conscience, Melanie's Awakening. And I designed the book to where you don't have to have read the first book in order to understand the next book in the series. And that's what's important, I think, in a series. You make it to where the person within – someone told me recently that within 7 pages – she hadn't read the first book. She's reading the second one. She really likes it. But she knew within 7 pages who all the characters were and what had brought them to where they were at.
Okay.
So it's the second book, so I think it's a lot better than the first. But, you know, I like the first too. But the Melanie's Awakening is – well, we can go into more detail after the break as to what the big theme is in that one.
Certainly. Let's do that. Freedom from Conscience. And we're going to talk more about that and much more, of course, in the second hour as well. So stay with us. We'll take a short break here and we'll be right back with more.
Thank you.
Proceed with our second hour for members. As usual, sign up for a membership and listen to any programs whenever you want. You can download, stream, subscribe to our RSS feeds, and we of course spare you from commercial interruptions. Check out redicemembers.com
for more information. In our second hour, Mike covers the brain chemistry of a psychopath. Then we'll discuss politics from the elite's point of view, such as environmental issues, population, employment, and globalization. Later, Mike talks about the image of a patriot today and what is now deemed as socially acceptable. He speaks more about how society is being cultivated and morphed into a war-minded society. Stay with us to learn more. But before we proceed, I want to let you know that next on Red Eyes Radio, we have Seth Farber and Paul Levy with us to talk about the spiritual gift of madness. We have many more guests upcoming, and you can see a full list in our radio archive, both at redeyescreations.com and redeyesmembers.com. We'll be right back with Hour 2 with Mike Cross.